Good afternoon and welcome to Thursday edition of Speak Out. Hi there, I'm Kevin Shepherdson. It's a beautiful day in Havasu, and I've got Brian Springberg, our certified financial planner here from Springberg McAndrew Financial Services and Insurance. Hi there, Brian, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Well, I'm doing really well.
Glad to hear it. Yeah, just find ourselves another beautiful day in the neighborhood and enjoying it.
Absolutely.
And market's down just slightly.
Yeah, a tad.
Just a tad, as they say. Market's just slightly below, again, all-time highs. Doing phenomenally. The U.S. Market, S&P 500, up somewhere in the neighborhood of 25% year-to-date. So if we even just don't make another nickel for the rest of the year, it'll be a phenomenal year in the market. But time will tell. We still got a little ways to go. You never know what you know, the short term will bring in terms of volatility. But for right now, things do look strong. You know, there's been a lot of diligence and vigilance by the Federal Reserve and, to make sure that interest rates have been kept very low to help stimulate and keep the economy moving forward. The hope and promise of a tariff, resolution and trade deal with China keeps the market, feeling positive. That is definitely something that could cause the market to go the other direction if, it looks like those talks are going to fall apart. However, for right now, it does look like there's some positive momentum, and we can continue to see that. Markets around the world today also down some, down a little bit steeper than where the U.S. sits right now, but still on the whole, year-to-date, doing quite well. One of the areas that has had a tremendous bounce back along with the U.S. market is the emerging markets, and that might be counterintuitive a little bit because you're thinking, well, isn't, you know, China really getting beat up? Isn't China having a terrible year? You know, China represents, of course, a big portion of what we call emerging markets. These are countries whose economies are relatively new to developing and capitalism and growth, although they, of course, are not new, and in fact, their cultures and societies have been along a heck of a lot longer than ours, but are really starting, you know, only in the last, you know, 3, 4, or 5 decades to kind of come into their own. China, India, South Korea, Brazil, countries of that ilk. And so these emerging markets can be more volatile because they're not proven yet, but there is a lot of feeling that over the long run they're going to continue to do very well, because that's really the way many people look at it is, well, what drives economies? And oftentimes it's the middle class. It's an emerging middle class that's buying things. And so that's, for the first time in history, we're seeing those kinds of things happen. In fact, almost all future growth in the world's middle class is going to be coming from emerging markets. And so that doesn't mean that the United States can't benefit from it. The United States needs to have extremely strong trade deals penetration into these markets to be able to take advantage of it, because it is a global marketplace. That's why you have to be careful as a country to walk the line between having trade deals that, you know, protect American workers and are beneficial to our economy in the long run, and at the same time not create enmity and ill feeling and conflict between us and these other economies because of, you know, the fact that we may be denied as much access or may not have as good a trade relationship with them in the future as these other economies and markets around the world continue to grow. So it's a line that you kind of got to walk because it's not as easy as, you know, America first and, you know, kind of the bird to everybody else. You just can't go down that road, because as the rest of the developing world, emerging markets grow, they will, just by math, take up a bigger piece of the pie of the global economy. And that same math means that we take up a smaller piece of pie in that economy. Now, there's no, we still remain the 800-pound gorilla. We are by far the longest and largest and strongest economy. But just by population basis, as I think I've mentioned on the show just as recently as last week, we maybe got a couple of decades before China is definitely going to surpass us. Why? Well, because they got three or four times as many people. Think of that. Three or four times as many people. And if they suddenly have a middle class emerging over several decades, then instead of having 100 million in the middle class, they have 500 million in the middle class buying stuff. And that's, of course, what contributes to the gross domestic product, the GDP of an economy, is something that it will be interesting to see us navigate. Historically, of course, there's always been an ebb and flow in terms of that. But the United States, as far as most people alive today, has always been the largest economy and the big dog, so to speak. But that will change. The question is when, and the question is how big picture thinking today will put us in a position to be stronger, down the road. And that is a key part of what's happening. If we kind of look at, regional contribution to the middle class, and by 2030 in terms of millions of people. So here's the numbers. India, the biggest, 594 million added to the middle class over the next decade. China, 547 million. Rest of Asia, 328 million. Sub-Saharan Africa, 80 million. Middle East and North Africa, 57 million. And then eventually, North America, 10 million. North America, of course, includes Mexico. And that'll be, would be the primary contributor because, of course, the United States and Canada, more developed, wouldn't be adding as much. So that's predominantly, I would assume, a Mexico number. Interesting stat, though. Europe, -3. Europe is predicted to actually have a negative amount of people in the middle class 10 years from now. Now, they didn't break this study out. By the way, this is from the Brookings Institution and J.P. Morgan Asset Management. So if you were to break out the United States out of the North American number, I wonder what we would be, individually. And if we would be in a similar cast as Europe itself, because I definitely don't think we're one of the biggest contributors to that. And then if you talk, well, what about the sectors? Really, where are we going to be seeing the development of the sectors in terms of that growth? Well, we can kind of look at what happened over the last decade, from 2009 to 2019. In 2009, emerging markets comprised 22% of technologies industry penetration around the world. 10 years later, 27%. Consumerism, and this is the big one. Consumerism, 11% 10 years ago. Emerging markets now, their stocks comprising 20%. So the equities, meaning the stock of the world, has increased in emerging markets by 9 percentage points over the last decade. So technology and consumerism, and that's really what we're focusing on. The United States' economy is based 70% upon consumerism, people just buying things. That's as opposed to manufacturing, that's as opposed to technology, that's as opposed to some other things. This consumerism is just us because we love our shopping, we love our malls, we love our Amazon, we love restaurants, all of those things. Well, middle class is going to be a big part of that. And so that's why you've seen that already starting to occur in emerging markets. And that trend is going to obviously continue. And so when we think about what sectors to invest in for emerging markets, that's a further breakdown, and meaning if you've got a risk tolerance, because emerging markets, like I mentioned, there's a little bit more of a risk to that because they are more volatile, they're a little bit less proven. However, if you do have time and the risk tolerance to invest in that, not only do you want to consider emerging markets, but you kind of want to consider, well, what sectors are most likely to benefit? And if you want to take a little more risk, then you concentrate in those sectors. And if you really want to increase your risk and potential return, why, that's when you start looking at individual companies within those sectors. And that is kind of how you start thinking about investing big picture for the long run. We got to go to our first break of the hour. We'll be right back here on Sound Advice and Speak Out. Any questions, feel free to give me a shout.
You can call us at 854-5687, 854-KNTR.
Take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey, Joe, take a walk on the...
We're back here on Speak Out here on this Thursday, brought to you by Patio Paradise, SunPower by Esme Electric, Sam Shooter's Emporium, Shagru's Family of Restaurants, Herb's Herbs, Mills Brothers Furniture and Sleep Center, and Realty Executives, Lake Havasu City. We're back with Sound Advice here on KNTR Talk with Brian Springberg.
So, yeah, we continue to enjoy what a phenomenal bull market run in the stock market. Currently, the U.S. market's bull or up market long-term trend is pushing just under 11 years. The average length for all 11 bull markets that have taken place since 1950, including the current one, is 5.33 years. If you take out the current one, well, that obviously reduces that number. So we are definitely far more than twice as long in the current bull market than historically has occurred. There's some confidence in that, like I said, because of, you know, we started low, had a long way to go up, and then two, it's been a slow and steady increase as opposed to huge leaps and bounds. When there's huge leaps and bounds in the market, that's when there is some cause for concern. This year, pushing 25% and maybe even higher, that causes some long-term investors to pause and think, I wonder when that shoe may drop. And of course, when it does, more than likely, it'll be temporary. It shouldn't be that too deep because currently it doesn't look like there's any big bubbles in terms of certain and specific areas, but maybe just a natural cycle. We got a call.
Yeah, we do. Caller, you're on the air here on Speak Out.
I'd like to know if I can get the advantages and disadvantages of a living trust.
Okay. So, absolutely, if you want to listen off the air, I'll give you my thoughts and breakdown on it from a financial advisor's perspective. That sound okay?
Will do. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you. So the first thing I'll say is I am not an attorney. Disclaimer, disclaimer, disclaimer. But of course, I work with attorneys quite a bit. I work with estate planning consistently. And actually, when it comes to trust and when people do pass away and then filing of claims and dealing with the assets and investments that were implemented at one point, I am on the front lines of this. And so I'll give you a very general outline of some considerations. Living trust is typically a revocable living trust, which just means that the person or couple doing that can change and amend that trust at any time. They have control over the assets in it and can put assets in and take them out at their discretion. One of the advantages to it is that it does bypass probate. Probate is the orderly, court system, judicial system put in place for the dispensation of assets. So just passing out people's investments and assets that they have to their beneficiaries and heirs. And probate does require usually some help from an attorney. It requires a little bit of involvement with paperwork and some expense and administration. It's not the end of the world. But a trust bypasses that process because now there is a system in place, there is paperwork in place, which spells out how it's to happen directly instead of needing to go through the probate process. Probate is open for every state in which you own an asset of a certain value. So if you own, let's say, a house in like Havasu City and you own a house in Colorado, or you have a piece of the family farm in Nebraska, you would have probate open in California, Nebraska, and Arizona, meaning three separate probates, potentially three separate attorneys, and three separate systems. And so the cost and expense and administration and time and all that all goes up. By having a trust where all the assets are held in it and no probate occurring, you bypass that particular problem. The other thing that a trust can do for you is that not only does it say who gets what, like a will might, and by the way, your wills still do go through probate, but it is spelled out and it's much more orderly. Not having a will is when you die, it's called intestate. And that means that first, it must be determined and legally proved who your heirs are and who's living, and there's an orderly system for that. Meaning, if your spouse is alive, then your spouse is first in line, even if you didn't spell that out in a will or a trust. Then children, then if not children, then parents, and then if not parents, brothers and sisters, and then it kind of just goes all over the place with that. But those things all need to be determined, and it takes time and effort. So definitely, everybody, do a will at the minimum. Trust, not only though, says who gets what like a will may, but a trust is like leaving a note on the fridge that says not only who gets what, but you can specify when they get it, meaning at an age 25 or 35, or after a certain number of years, or if they need the money, children need the money for college, or a certain expense. So it gives you the ability to maintain some control from beyond the grave, so to speak, if you are interested in that. Why would you do that? Well, you have a special needs child, you know, handicapped adult child. You have, your kid is addicted to drugs, alcohol, and you can't trust them to inherit, you know, $200,000 in, you know, cash proceeds. So you need somebody to dispense that money over time and have a little bit more control. The children are minor children, in which case you'll designate a successor trustee, meaning if a husband and wife pass away together, then they may name somebody else for their minor children to be in charge of the money to make sure that it's used appropriately for them and that it's invested correctly. And on down the line. Trust can also ease the transition of property. And so there are, that way it can reduce the amount of administrative effort required for property to transition, usually from a parent to a child. Usually the trust, you know, the husband and wife are co-trustees. One of them passes away. The remaining spouse is the trustee. But at that point, you're definitely going to want to make sure you also, and even on the front end, you have successor trustees. If the parents pass away together, then if there's three kids, you might name all three successor co-trustees, or you, if you have one that's more responsible and capable or versed in financial matters, then you may name them as a trustee to just disseminate the money all equally or however your wishes were indicated in the trust. Being the trustee doesn't mean you get more, it just means you're in charge of it. And sometimes you may compensate that person for the time and effort it takes to be the trustee. If it's a stranger, meaning if you hire a bank or an attorney's office to do that kind of work, then I guarantee you there will be expenses. And in a large estate, sometimes people do that. because they want to be sure that there's no hard feelings between children, and you have an impartial third party, and so they may charge 1% a year. So on a $1 million estate, the trustee might receive $10,000 in income for the year for the trouble of being a trustee, if that's exactly how it's set up. The last part I'll get into is, well, how do you go about setting up these wills and these trusts? And there are three ways to do it. And depending upon who you are and your capabilities and what your estate looks like, kind of dictates, in my opinion, what you should look to. The first is, in today's world, you can go online. You can find will and trust documents and, you know, LegalZoom.com or other purveyors like that. I don't know, $50 or $100 or whatever for the template paperwork, and kind of fill out your own. That is the most basic and easy thing to do. If you don't feel confident that you're going to end up doing it right and legally and in the way that you want things to actually go, the next level is typically a paralegal of some sort. In my office, we've got two paralegals who focus on trust, wills, deeds, and incorporation. Don't get into bankruptcies and divorce and, you know, criminal matters or anything like that. And the reason is just that the vast majority of the population does not need a sophisticated document or an expensive document to be able to get handled what they need to, because their assets aren't that complicated and aren't in multiple states. And so that can be handled typically less expensively by that. But there is no attorney present. If you say, listen, I want 100% confidence that this is handled up and up, or if you have a fairly large or sophisticated estate or wishes, then you definitely want to get an attorney involved. And the attorney is going to have, of course, more in-depth knowledge and background for a larger or sophisticated estate to make sure that the language is appropriate and reflects exactly what you want to do, and also may have some ideas to help you with some things that you may not have thought of on your own. But at the end of the day, do it. Do it, do it, do it. I can tell you that when it is not done correctly, or when it's not done at all, you make life so much more difficult on the people you leave behind. It's unnecessary. It's unfair because you didn't feel like, you know, spending, you know, $500 or $1,000 or whatever it is to make sure that you make life easier on the back end and that things are taken care of in an appropriate manner. Do it. I know that you hate talking about what happens if I'm, when I pass away, what happens if I'm in a coma and I can't make healthcare or financial decisions. These aren't fun conversations. I get it. But guess what? That happens, and it happens every day. And so taking these steps and making that a part of your financial plan is vital to make sure that you, not only that your wishes are carried out, but you just make life a little bit easier on those that you leave behind. So with that, we got to go to our second break of the hour. We'll be right back here on Sound Advice and Speak Up. Thursday Night Football tonight here on KNTR Sports 94.3 and 980 AM. It's the Steelers taking on the Browns. Game starts at 6:20 here on KNTR here in Lake Havasu City. Hour. Let's look at the community calendar on this Thursday. Today, Northern Arizona VA Healthcare System Town Hall is happening at the library. It starts at 3:30 this afternoon, goes till 5 p.m. Get answers to questions on VA benefits at the Lake Havasu Clinic. Also today, Havasu Regional Medical Center Auxiliary has a $6 jewelry and accessory sale, and that is today and tomorrow at the hospital lobby. Today till 4 p.m., tomorrow 7 a.m. till 2 p.m. There's all kinds of jewelry and all kinds of stuff that's going to be on sale there at the library. Coming up on Friday, the Side-by-Side Expo Madness Pre-Party at Legend Sports Bar and Grill at 7 p.m. It's a free event, Side-by-Side Contest,
judging best side-by-side in of vehicles here in Havasu. If you want more information, 951-501-0210. That's the number to call. Friday through Sunday, there's the Lake Havasu Paddle Fest at the Lake Havasu State Park. Friday, the camp set up, noon to 6 p.m. And Saturday and Sunday, we'll have tournaments and product demos. It's $29 to attend it. It's 928-680-9251. That's the number to call for more information. Friday through Sunday, it's Aeda at Grace Arts Live. Performances are Friday and Saturday at 7:30 in the evening and Sunday at 2 p.m. $28 for adults, $15 for 17 and under. Call 928-505-2787 for more information and tickets. Also on Saturday, Lake Havasu Grand Prix at the Crazy Horse Campground, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. The tickets are $10 for adults, 6 through 12, $5. Spectators are welcome. And this number is the number to call for more information, 623-363-9665. Coming up on Saturday, Farmers Market at Cause on McCulloch, 8 a.m. to noon. Veterans Appreciation Poker Run at the Moose Lodge, number 1860 in Bullhead City. Starts at 8 a.m. $25 to get into that poker run and $15 if you're a co-rider. Western Arizona Flea Market is at the Western Arizona Humane Society on Sweetwater from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Food vendors will be there. New and used items will be sold. Elkettes have a craft and bake sale at the Elks Lodge at 8 a.m. Proceeds go to charity. And the Sand, Water, and RV Expo is at Lake Havasu State Park on Saturday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. and on Sunday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. This number is the number to call, 951-501-0210. And that's the number to call for information about the Sand, Water, and RV Expo. And that's it for the community calendar. Let's go back to Brian Springberg with sound advice here on KNTR Talk.
So I was telling you how the U.S. market up about 25.5% or so as of just a couple of days ago. Well, the leading sector by far this year specifically is technology, up in excess of 40%. In fact, if you were to take out four specific companies from the S&P 500, so four out of the 500 companies, those companies would be Apple, those companies would be Amazon, Google, I don't know, can't think of the fourth off the top of my head, but you know them. The S&P 500 returned would drop by 10% year to date. So the other 495 companies comprised about 15% of the return, and the other four companies, 10%. So extremely concentrated. So if you're looking at your U.S. large cap growth fund and you're like, hey, I'm up 18% or 19%, I'm up 25, well, that's because there's not a giant concentration, while definitely some ownership, I'm sure, of those companies I mentioned, not a giant concentration of those companies. Doesn't mean you should run out and buy those companies, by the way, especially at some highs, but it's just interesting to know how concentrated the returns of the, quote, U.S. market really is concentrated in just four or five stocks. Interesting. And that, of course, is why technology is leading by far as the number one sector so far year to date in the U.S. markets. Followed from there, from that 40%+ return, is industrials at 29%, followed by consumer services at 28%, financials at 27.4%. The sector lagging the most so far is the energy sector, up just about 8.5% to 9% year to date. If we just look at what trends are doing, well, they're all over the map in current weeks. Usually focusing on the ultra short term isn't real healthy, although something you do want to pass your mind over from time to time. Gold doing fairly well as of just a little bit less than a week ago at 1,400 $1,264 an ounce, up from $1,279 an ounce, 12/31 of 18. And so year to date, the price of gold up about $185-$190 an ounce. CDs certainly have improved from where they were, as I've been giving these reports over the last couple of years. The six-month CD currently at 0.79 percent. Well, I used to throw out, you know, 0.2 and 0.3. So 0.79 certainly an improvement, although obviously not a home run by any stretch. 30-year mortgages continue to be low, especially from historical perspectives, hovering somewhere around 4% or so, depending upon your credit and the size of the loan and other factors. You know, you might actually end up a little bit higher than that, but depending, you may find yourself somewhere in that neighborhood as far as purchasing a new home. And home ownership continues to be a fairly robust part of the economy because, of course, as mortgage rates fall or rise to some extent, so does housing growth increase or decrease. And, of course, that makes total and complete sense. And as we look at the third quarter of 2019 this year, it's up just slightly after actually decreasing the previous four or five quarters. And that's because interest rates dropped just a little bit in the mortgage department from where they were. And as a result of that, we saw people starting to buy just a few more homes because financing your home is obviously a big part of your overall expense. And at the end of the day, you want to spend as less as you can over time. And in fact, one of the mistakes that people are starting to make a little bit more is that debt, as they get older, is not going away relative to their housing as much as it used to. In 2016, 46% of American homeowners between the ages of 65 and 79 had outstanding mortgage debt on their primary residence. That is almost double from the 24% of this age bracket that had mortgage debt 30 years earlier. Think on that. Think on that. That twice as many people 30 years ago. Well, let me rephrase that. There are now twice as many people today than 30 years ago who have outstanding mortgage debt who are between the ages of 65 and 79. Meaning that people are getting to retirement age, and rather than having a cash flow that is a little bit more beneficial because they do not have a mortgage payment going out the door for $1,100, $1,200, $1,500, $2,300, you know, $3,500, whatever it is a month, they still have that debt. They still have that burden. Well, you know, it makes a little bit of sense from the argument that people are living longer, people are working longer, and so you want to be sure. So it makes sense that, you know, maybe they're not paying it off as quickly as they once were from 30 years ago. But that doesn't account for the majority of that. And keep in mind how important it is to get to retirement with less debt in your home. Usually the biggest source of that debt is something you want to focus on not having a payment on when you do arrive there. Hopefully this trend does not continue. We got to go to our last break of the hour. We'll be right back here on Sound Advice and Speak Out.
We're back here on Speak Out here on this Thursday, brought to you by Bradley Chevrolet, Ford, and Lincoln, by Springberg McAndrew Financial Services, Horizon Community Bank, Connected Computer and Technology, GDK CPA LLC, and Kingman Force on Force. We're back with Sound Advice with Brian Springberg.
So, good news in the economy, unemployment request from jobless people have dropped. The actual jobless number, it remains at historic 50-year lows. The stock market is doing extremely well so far this year, and so we can point to a lot of positives. Of course, there's never such thing as a perfect economy, never will be. Something always has to give, it would seem, doesn't it? And you know, the couple of things that you want to hope that the politicians and your governments will start paying increased attention to remain the fact that in this robust economy, not every not everybody's participated on the upside, meaning that meaningful wage growth for a lot of people who are in the service sector. Again, we've been through this, right, where the type of jobs that we would hope for that actually exist, that exist, that people are not trained for, that people are not educated for, are not being filled, that might help them get that leg up. And instead, there's so many people concentrated in the service sector, which obviously doesn't have the same wage base to be able to compensate for that. But the other thing is that is the booming economy and stock market coming with too high of a cost? And in the short term, of course, the answer is no, because we're in the middle of it and we are all enjoying it. But that cost is real. In fact, for the most recent fiscal year of the U.S. government is the 12 months ending September 30, 2019. So the federal government's fiscal year ends is you know, September to September. So September 30th, 2019, the government had receipts, tax income, of $3.462 trillion and outlays of $4.447 trillion. So with a little bit of math obviously tells you that we are short a little bit less than $1 trillion, which is our annual deficit. That's the equivalent to taking in a dollar worth of, so let's say you're a business and you have customers coming through the door all day, and for every dollar a customer gives you to buy your stuff, it costs you, I'm sorry, you're turning around and you're spending $1.28 to be able to give the things that the customer's buying. So in other words, it costs you 28% more to do what you do for a living, or sell what you sell, or create what you create, then you receive an income. So for every dollar in tax revenue, our government is spending $1.28 just this past fiscal year. If we kind of break it down a little bit more, in October, from October of 2018 through to this most recent October, the federal government's budget deficit rose 34% from a year earlier. So October's federal, where we were in last October in the federal deficit, increased October over October by 34%. Spending continues to be a gigantic problem. And so while we see the benefit of the tax cut in the short term, it has not been accompanied with a cut in spending in the short term, which means that the economy that we are all enjoying now, it becomes a little bit more questionable, because it's not as though it's occurring organically. It's occurring because the Federal Reserve has kept interest rates at historic lows, meaning that it's stimulating the economy through a fiscal policy of sorts. And by cutting tax revenue and keeping spending as though we haven't cut tax revenue, then we just continue to build what at some point becomes an unsustainable amount of debt for the United States of America. And unfortunately, the way politicians work is that they're not always focused on, well, I wonder if this is really what we need to be doing for the next 10, 20, 50 years for the health of our country. It's, what do I need to be doing for things to be in the right place when re-election comes around? I can point to the current state of affairs within our economy. And unfortunately, that's always kind of existed, that mentality. It's nothing new, but it seems more and more exaggerated because it's, you know, people get into office, it's like their re-election campaign starts within months after getting into office. It's, whether it's 4 years in the House or the president or 6 years as a senator, it just seems like this never-ending cycle, doesn't it? I mean, think of it this way. You're going to start seeing your political campaign signs everywhere just next year again. Don't you love that? So, you know, pounding those stakes into the ground and, you know, seeing that and going through this cycle. The beauty is democratic elections are a wonderful, wonderful way to run a country when they are, in fact, you know, done you know, democratically and when it feels that things are going the way that the electorate wants it to go. But as I've indicated on the show before, there's these mind-blowing studies that show that regardless of what the population of the country leans to as a majority, whether it's for or against something, that it becomes law the same. Meaning that if 70% of the country feels strongly about some kind of legislation, or whether they don't, there's the same percentage chance of it becoming law, whether you feel that way or not. That is statistically the way it works and not reflecting things. Kind of a tangent. I don't know. I guess it's soapbox time for me to kind of go there. But it's still just frustrating when I, you know, I feel so good about, you know, the short term and I think things are, you know, are definitely doing well. And then I get frustrated because at the same time I recognize not everything that benefits you in the short term is long term. And that's, it's kind of like, I don't know, what's the equivalent when you want to have a delicious piece of pie? It's like a moment on the lips and a lifetime on the hips or something like that. It's kind of how I feel we're spending money in this country. It's like, all right, a year of a fantastic economy is, you know, 50 years of, you know, deficit spending beyond me. I don't know. Poor analogy, but you know what I'm saying. With that, everybody, have a wonderful, safe weekend. Continue to enjoy this gorgeous weather. We'll look forward to catching up with you next week here on Sound Advice and Speak Out.
All right. Thank you very much, Brian. You can contact him at 855-9421. All right. No 2.0 this week. Fox News is at the top of the hour. Thanks for listening today. Have a great afternoon. We'll be back tomorrow here at noon here on Speak Out.